Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and foes alike. I am the West Virginia woman, Robin Holstein of RobinHolstein.com and Holstein House, where my guests get a good night's sleep at a fair rate plus breakfast. I've been keeping house since I was 17 years old, balancing the budget and paying the bills as an Army wife on the salary of a PFC stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, and as a single mother of two back home in West Virginia. Things have changed a lot since then, but I haven't forgotten what it was like. This podcast looks at society and cultural issues affecting families in West Virginia and in the United States, from food preparation and storage, gardening, home repairs, current events, and more. We'll go round the table and back in 60 minutes or less. So let's hang out and talk a while. All righty. Kids, it's election day in the United States. Yay! Aren't we all just excited? You know, you can't wait. You know, you can't wait. Can't wait for it to be over. But you only get, what, a couple weeks worth of rest? Of course, they'll be arguing about it for 3 or 4 days. Heck, in Gore v. Bush, it was months. It was December. Was it after the first of the year? I can't remember now. You know, Al Gore was throwing a fit saying that he won. Would make him an election denier, wouldn't it? Anyway, they litigated that to death and everybody was tired of it. And it went the way most of us thought it would go. But you know, maybe they won't be that bad this time. I have seen on the news or heard, I'm not watching it, I had the radio playing, that there's some issues with machines not working in parts of the country. You know, let me say that. Because a little later on, I want to talk to you about a couple of books. From some good old-fashioned, real Southern West Virginia Democrat political bosses. The first book is Just Good Politics, The Life of Raymond Chafin, an Appalachian Boss. And I have met Mr. Chafin. Well, he's passed away now, but he came to my political science class back in 2000. I think it was in 2000. And then I Made a Difference, Earl B. Hager, educator and legislator. I actually worked with Mr. Hager. He was quite advanced in age when I did. I was a conservation district supervisor for a period of time, and he was as well on the same district. He was in a different district, but he was on some of the same committees. But anyway, I'm going to talk about those, and I've got some text highlighted that I'm going to read. It won't be terrible. I read fair. But now, today, I've been to an eye exam, so I've got this whole gigantic eyeball thing going on. And, you know, after you've been to an eye exam, it's kind of hard to find that balance. That's where I'm at today. But I have timed this so that we should not get an exceptional number of cuckoos from the clock today, because it's just after noon. We should hear it chime once at 12:30, once at 1 o'clock, and once at 1:30, but hopefully I should be done by way before 1:30. Except if, you know, I get the gift of gab, and I do that from time to time. So welcome, sorry about taking so long to get to that point, to the seventh episode number 7 of the Holstein House podcast, premiering here on the Fountain FM network. If you found me on Fountain, I hope you will boost me if you find anything I say of value to you or that you like. I mean, like is a value. It brought you entertainment or joy or something to think about. Feel free to clip. I don't think I have any native clips. I have a couple of clips out there that I did a few weeks ago. Well, it wouldn't be a few weeks ago. There's only been 7 episodes. But anyway, I did a few clips a while back for other things. But I hope you will find something I say today enlightening and educating and just a general good information to know. And of course, if you have a contrarian position, you feel free to comment. It's all well and good. As long as you're not foul. I mean, we've had this conversation before. I get that people use foul language. You can do that. I just ask you not to do it on my stuff and in my place. And because I don't like it. I don't use, well, it wouldn't matter if I used it at your place if you used it all the time. You get the picture. Just be polite. Don't be mean to people. That's one of those great leftist things. Except they're some of the biggest meanies out there. So, one of the things that I don't know why I didn't think about it before, but one of the things that I should have done when I first started this, either in episode one or two, was to share with you some information on one of my best girlfriends, Diana Mace. Diane, I've known her since, gosh, before my younger son was born. I've known her since about 1987. And we were family support group officers together when I was married to my first husband. And he was stationed. He was actually active duty, but he was at the Dunbar National Guard Armory. Back in the 80s, obviously, late 80s. So Diane and I worked together along with some other ladies to rebuild the family support group that was there. They had had one years before. It had fallen by the wayside, as these things sometimes do. And Diane and I helped to gather the ladies together, and we worked some bake sales and raised money and things to provide Christmas gifts and a Christmas party and a summer picnic and just different stuff like that that you do when you're in these support groups. And we held educational events. We would invite the ladies in to get their ID cards. Those, because even if you're a National Guard spouse, you can get an ID card. You're limited on how you can use it, but you can get an ID card so that, you know, during that's the way it used to be. During drill weekends and annual training and stuff like that, you could go to the commissary or the PX. I haven't been out there in 30 years. At that time, we had a small PX, about the size of a convenience store, small convenience store, gas station type. So, but we did a lot of good work. And then my former husband was transferred down to Williamson. And he worked down there in southern West Virginia, just across the river from Kentucky. And Diane ended up down there as well. But at that point, her husband, Bob, had gone to officer candidate school and was a lieutenant. And we worked together doing the same kind of stuff down there. And we helped to, and some of the guys got really mad at us too, because they were used to having those weekends to themselves. They told their wives it was a voluntary thing. I mean, there's a whole episode right there. But anyway, so some of the guys got mad that we were telling the women, number one, that the guys got paid, and number two, that they were eligible for military ID cards and the benefits and all the things that go along with serving in the National Guard. But, so I've known Diane a long time, and she's been one of my longtime good friends. And, she has been diagnosed with a disease called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, if I pronounced that correctly. It's kind of like having, alcoholic cirrhosis, except there's no alcohol involved. She's not a drinker, never has been. And they abbreviate it as NASH, NASH. And as it worsens, you know, you can't live without your liver. So as it worsens, her weight goes down. She can't eat. She's just lethargic. There's a whole lot of things that you don't think about. you don't think about, because most of us never have to deal with those kind of things. And she is at the point now where she absolutely has to have a liver transplant. Now, as odd as that sounds, the liver will regenerate. It will grow back. And if you are the proper blood type, and in Diane's case, it would be an O negative or O positive blood type, you can donate. What they do is they take a portion of your liver. They don't take your entire liver. They take a portion of your liver and donate it to the individual. If it's a child, they take a small portion. If it's an adult, though, they take a pretty hefty piece. And yours will grow back, and ideally, her body won't reject the donor, and she'll be able to get a little bit of normalcy back in her life and a more traditional lifespan. Now, I wouldn't ask you to do something I don't do. I did reach out to the University of Virginia, which is where she is assigned to work through. And they have a live organ donor program, and I've put a link down in the show notes for that. And I contacted the lady out there that's working with Diana, and I said, I want to try this. She said, are you sure? I said, oh, yeah. I don't think I could live with myself if I didn't. She's been a good friend to me for a long time, and I mean, you know, here we go. So I went through, I filled out everything that had to be filled out, and then I had some lab works done and gave them permission to check my medical history. And some of the medications I take for some of the issues I have, plus my age. Now, I wasn't technically beyond the cutoff for the age. I think 60 is the cutoff, if I remember. But the upper level of my age combined with some of the medications that I have to take threw me out. I really actually thought I was in pretty good health, which I am, but not for that. So part of that program, so if you were to volunteer to be a donor and you passed all the checks and you were approved, what happens is her medical insurance pays your expenses related to the organ donation. So your travel for medical tests and such things to University of Virginia, or maybe another one for all I know. I mean, you may be able to do it somewhere. I don't know if you have to be right down there or not, because I didn't get that far. Your travel, your room and board while you're there, all hospital related expenses related to the operation and everything, your travel back for follow-up if there's required any, medications if you need any related to the transplant, all of that's covered by Diane's insurance, not you, not the donor. So she's been on the transplant list for over a year now, and she can even, if it's the right blood type and the right conditions, she can even have a donated liver from a cadaver, but that's getting kind of, well, you know, COVID. One of the terrible things about all those lockdowns that you don't think about, people not traveling as much, there's not as many fatal vehicle accidents, and therefore a smaller supply of donated organs. And that's really kind of cold to think about. The first time I thought about that, I thought, man, that's just terrible. But I don't want to call it an industry, because it's not like somebody goes out there and forces you to have a wreck so that it kills you so that you have to donate your organs. But there is a market. Is that the best word? I don't even know if market's the best word, but that's why they encourage you to be an organ donor and have it on your ID card. So that if something like that happens, you died at the scene, died shortly after at the hospital or something, they check the card, you're an organ donor, no time is wasted, and you could save other lives. So with fewer people traveling and all that, you get the idea. I don't have to go along. I'm not talking to kindergartners here, and I don't mean to pretend that I am. but sometimes I do ramble. So, you know, if she also has a GoFundMe, and I know people, there are people who despise GoFundMe. I get it. This isn't about me or your opinion of GoFundMe. Diana chose GoFundMe for a reason, probably because it was the most familiar one to her and one of the most well-known at the time she created it. Throwing all the political issues aside, she does have a GoFundMe. She could use more donations because this keeps dragging out. Her insurance does not reimburse her travel and meals to go to the doctor. So when she has to go to the University of Virginia for checkups and follow-ups and tests and all these things, her room and board, her meals, none of that's covered by her insurance. It's coming out of her pocket. So, you know, if you are of the mind to contribute a couple bucks, I would rather actually you dropped $5 in her GoFundMe than to, you know, drop $5 worth of Satoshis, or heck, 5 cents worth of Satoshis. So, I mean, you can be anonymous if you want. You can out yourself if you want. You can say, Robin told me to on the fountain.fm app. You know, Robin gave up her Satoshis for you to have, you know, gas money. I don't really care. I would rather you did that. I really would. I just would rather you, and I have donated some cash to her, you know, in person cash to her, and some cash through the GoFundMe to help spin that up a little bit. And my son has, and some other folks have, but she's at the point now where she's needing a little more cash to cover some of the bills. So again, you know, I went through, I was ready to do it. I mean, it was going to be kind of a challenge. I was really scared to death, but when they told me you're not a good match, I was heartbroken. I just couldn't believe it. I was really upset for several days. If you know of other people, if you please share her story around and say, you know, would you consider dropping a couple bucks here for her? That would be great. She's been a wonderful, faithful wife to her husband, Bob. She has been a faithful mother and loving mother to her children, who have each in their own way, even as adult children, had some challenges that she had to help them through. And her grandson, who for a little while she had guardianship over while there was some difficulties going on. So, I mean, she is a selfless person, really. And I hate to see her in this condition. So please check that link down below, not only just her GoFundMe, but also the University of Virginia's link to the organ donor site. Thank you. Thank you for even thinking about it, really. And for those of you who pray, please pray for her. On a little lighter note, more like the Jeez Louise note, have you fallen for the "we need to make daylight savings time permanent" bandwagon yet? Oh my gosh, I hope not. I hope you have better sense than that. If not, I'm sorry. You know, just please. Daylight savings is not the natural or original time in, there's one, time for us in the United States, and of course, still some countries across the world. Now there are states that don't observe it, and bravo. But for lack of a better word, it's a legitimate time. You know, it's what the time was before, not daylight savings, but where we're at now, standard time. There's a reason it's called standard. So there's people are screaming about the 2022 fall back, like we're losing daylight because it's dark at 5:30. No. We have the same amount of daylight, plus or minus a minute or two, depending on what day of the week it is right now. Do they not teach in public school anymore that the Earth cycles around the sun in 365 and a quarter days a year? We adjust in the fourth year. We add that day to February, leap year, they like to call it, to balance that out. And it has, we're not losing daylight because of the way we set the clocks. We're losing daylight because of the natural cycle of the Earth around the sun. And at this time of the year, the northern hemisphere is tilting away from the sun, the southern hemisphere tilting toward the sun, thus reducing the amount of daylight in the northern hemisphere and extending the amount of daylight in the southern hemisphere. So we are entering fall winter and they are entering spring summer. Huh. How hard is it? It's not. It's not. But there, I watched friends of mine, and you know, I'll put a couple of posts up on the FB page, and but I don't spend a lot of time dickering about it, because I, you know, I'm like, well, you know, now instead of it being daylight where I live, it's daylight at 8:15 after the kids are already in school. They boarded the school buses in the dark. They arrived to the school in the dark, and they're in the classroom and it's dark. Now it's daylight at 7:15. The kids are maybe getting to the bus stop and it's still being a little dark, but they're getting on the bus as it's daylight, as the twilight comes, and get driving, you know, to the school in the daylight, and they're getting off the bus in the daylight, which is safer for the kids getting on and off the bus. Now, another story for another day is how long some of our kids have to ride the school bus to get to the classroom, which in some cases is an hour. It's insane. But that's, you know, different story another day. I should write all these down, really. I should keep a notepad here and just jot these down as they come to me. But, you know, it's just ridiculous. They do. Why do people think we're getting less daylight now? Because they're driving home in the dark? Well, if you're leaving in the dark and driving home in the dark, it doesn't make much of a difference, does it? Now, my husband drives an hour each way to work. He leaves in the dark no matter what time of the year it is. And he comes home in the dark this time of year. Now, you know, through the summer and stuff, it's still daylight when he gets home, especially when it's daylight till 9 p.m. under daylight savings time, which would be 8 p.m. if we were on standard time. Anyways, it's insane. Don't fall for it. You're smarter than that. You're smarter than that. There's nothing really to tell you about the garden. Other than I did get some of my, well, I got all of my, actually, all of my containers emptied of the soil that was in them. And I've heard a couple people, more than a couple people, complaining about the quality of the soil that they bought this year. Like with me, I don't have a way to compost enough natural materials to fill up my containers. So even with my chickens and ducks and stuff, I don't have access to what I need to do that. I don't have the time to access what I need to do that. And I don't have the space I need. So I am mostly dependent on purchasing soil, potting soil, container soil, and things like that, topsoil even, from the box stores. I hate it. I really hate it. I've thought about, there is a feed store in Charleston, but I would have to get my pickup truck filled with it. I could do that, but it would take several loads. I would have to think that through a little more. But for my containers, probably my pickup truck full, which is the least amount that I would be able to get, a couple scoops, I guess, would be more than I need. I need to think through that some more before spring and find out where they source their topsoil, because if it's just bulk from the same place as the box stores do, I don't want that. You just go to the box store. Probably be cheaper depending on how much gas it takes to get down there by then. Whew, gas prices. Still very high. Thank you very much. So I did a little garden cleanup. We haven't had a good frost. We had a little bit of a frost, but it wasn't enough to get. I have cannies. I think they're called cannies. They're a rhizome plant with these big old green leaves, and they have a flower shoot that comes up probably about 6 foot, and it has a beautiful red flower on it. The plant itself is nice looking. The problem with the plant is that you have to dig it up every fall, or so they say. Now, the ones on the west side of my house, I've never dug them up. I was fine if they died. And the rhizomes are coming up out of the ground. It's crazy. So I really wanted to get those up out of there this year because I want to extend the flower beds, if you want to call them that, and put more flowering vegetable type, you know, permaculture light, if you want to call it that, out this year instead of traditional annual flowers. There's a few plants that I don't know what to do with. I've got a lavender plant that I'd probably just leave in place because it's established, it's big, it's gorgeous, it smells so good. I hate to disturb it. And I haven't had much luck transplanting my roses. Every time I've transplanted a rose bush, it dies. So I don't know, I'm doing something wrong, but I'm taking out a lot of soil. I'm not letting them get dry. The hole's as big as the hole I took it out of. I'm going through all those steps, and they're just dying. I might just do well. The one that I've got that I would really need to move, it's got something weird going on with it. The flowers aren't really pretty. They're kind of all. For those of you on the podcast who couldn't see what I just did, I took my hands and kind of scrunched them and twisted them around like, I don't know, just a gesture. So I'm still thinking through some of that. I really want to have more food crops in my flower beds that look nice and are practical, not just for looks like that ornamental cabbage stuff, that are practical than just flowers. I spent more than enough on flowers over the years. It's time to stop that. So on the home here, well, kids, the test on the biopsies that I had done were actually conclusive. They came back Monday, and I had three places biopsied. Two of them turned out to be basal cell carcinoma. Now, the one that we were most concerned with, that the dermatologist said, whoa, wait a minute, you know, and she felt sure that it was the one up by my left eye, along the side of my nose, up at my left eye. And the other one, and I know you can't see me on the podcast, but the other one is right at the upper part of where the arm and the chest meet, which would be above the armpit, in the fold. So it's really sore just from the biopsy because it's in that fold. And every time I move my arm, it hurts. But so I have those two places actually, and I'm waiting to hear from the surgeon to schedule the surgery. I'm going to assume that they're not in too big of a hurry because basal cell carcinoma, according to the Skin Cancer Foundation, it rarely spreads beyond the original tumor site. It can get, you know, if you don't have it taken off, it can get big. It can compromise the tissue around where it is. It's not like it's spreading like from the spot at my eye down to my knees or anything. It can spread in place, but it doesn't like travel through the body. Untreated, it can be locally invasive, grow wide and deep and destroy tissue and bone. So that's why I'm really more concerned with this spot here at my eye, is if it spreads down into, you know, the nose cartilage, you know, and tears that up. What kind of a place am I going to have when they remove it? which is not what I should be worried about. I mean, I need to get it cleared up and not worry about looks, but you know what we do, don't we? So I'm just waiting for the surgery appointment now. It's, you know, not like heart disease or ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer is really nasty because you don't know you have it for a long time. And then by the time they find it, sometimes they just can't deal with it. They can remove the ovaries, but little small cells have spread. It's similar with breast cancer, I understand as well. We have a musician friend, Jean Hannah Davis, who has been a long-term survivor of breast cancer. She stays on medication, keeps it in remission, but she's been around a lot longer than they initially thought she would be. So she's done very well. And I mentioned before, this is the 7th episode of the Holstein House podcast, premiering on the Fountain Network. I was going to do this, and I forgot to do this. I was going to do that. For all y'all out in TV land, forgot to do that. For those of you on the podcast, I just kicked up a little banner that says, be sure to like, boost, and subscribe. I promise it will get better. Can't get much worse. I heard that. So, over on the Fountain app, HJ asked me for my thoughts on Bitcoin. It'll probably surprise a lot of people who are smarter than me. I wouldn't want every dollar of my wealth, or however you measure your wealth, whether it's dollars or jewelry or whatever, to be in Bitcoin. I don't want, you know, I want diversification. Some dollars, some land, some tangibles, some Bitcoin. Some retirement, which may be an intangible. It might not be there this time next week because depending on, never mind, I'm not going to go there right now. I'm looking for a couple of good books or instructions on information on Bitcoin. I thought I had a line on one the other day, and of course you're supposed to put your email address in there. So I put my email address in there and I got nothing. So I'm going to try it again. It's a couple of young fellas that seem pretty smart on it. I'm not going to out them here because I want to give a chance to figure out what's going on. They do post on Fountain FM, and they have a new-ish YouTube page. They only have a couple of videos up on YouTube. I don't even remember how I tripped across of them. It's hard to tell, but you know, I want to set a goal, and I say want, and there's people who say, well, you either set it or you don't. I've got to have more information before I do this. But if I'm comfortable with the decision that I have right now, once I read some more up on it, I think I want to have about 2 Bitcoins. I think I want to own 2 Bitcoin. That would then, I think today, I don't remember what time I saw the message, but I think today Bitcoin was down a little bit. It's a little under $19,000. So that, let's just round that up, call it 20 for this. And so $40,000 in Bitcoin, I think would be a good number. Can I do that? Maybe I can. If it drops far enough and I buy some, or if I can manage to start charging or offering for payments for the Airbnb, for the B&B, for the things that I'm, the packages and trainings and things that I'm trying to pull together now, if I can get paid with Satoshis and pieces of Bitcoin, you know, I might be able to do it. Who knows? Who knows? So that's not really an answer to your question, HJ, I don't think. I like it. I want to like it more. But I need some more information. I need to understand better all of the pieces. I understand that there's a finite, if you can call anything digital finite, finite number of whole Bitcoin. And so we're all just, it's like a finite amount of gold. And we're all just dealing with chips of it, little bits and pieces and flakes of it. I get that. What I'm struggling with is finding out exactly what the other pieces are. I know that if I have paper money and coins, U.S. coins, at one time, they were tied to gold. Now, for this example, I'm just going to pretend that they still are because, so they represent a finite, these dollars and coins represent a finite amount of gold. And I can take those dollars and that change, those coins, and put them in my billfold or wallet, my change purse, whatever. And I can carry those around with me and risk getting them stolen. I can put them in the bank and risk the bank going under and have to go beg the bank for my money. I can put them in a safe, hoping that nobody ever figures out they're in that safe. And I can go and take them out, take out what I need, the rest of it back, and carry this amount on my person. With Bitcoin, it's not the paper money. It's the digital idea. There's a digital wallet and a digital something that goes in the safe. And I don't know if those are just two different wallets. If one is like your checkbook to your bank and one is an actual, is more the like the wallet that goes into the safe in the, you know, in the basement. Or I think that's it. I don't know. And then, so I don't know what a node is, where it comes into play. And I don't know how to invoice, although I do have that, I do have a couple of apps. And you mentioned one a couple of comments back that I haven't looked at yet, but I have it written down. So I'm still kind of where I used to be, still trying to find out the answer to that. But I, in general, you know, I want to understand more about Bitcoin, and I want to procure Bitcoin. I want to earn Bitcoin, and I want to be able to work in that world a little bit. I don't ever see it being my, I don't see it being 100% of how I function and how I purchase things, but I think it could be a good alternative in addition to, just like, you know, you have your retirement accounts and different things. So, all right, so let's get on to election day stuff. So it's election day 2022 in the United States. It is a big deal. I do want people to educate themselves, and I do want people to vote. I know there's a large number of people in this kind of arena who say, I quit voting a long time ago. Well, it is my view that that is the big part of the problem. You've thrown your hands up and you've walked away. And so now the people who are making the decisions aren't accountable to you. And you might say, well, they're not accountable to anybody. Well, here, let me tell you part of the reason why. Okay. In the 2018 election, just 4 years ago, 2018, less than 40% of the people, of the young people eligible to vote, ages 18 to 29, only 40% of those people voted. Less than 40, actually. You might be saying, oh, good, because they're too stupid. No. We let 18-year-olds make the decision to go to war or not. They're considered adults, even if there are restrictions on alcohol and tobacco, which is dumb if you ask me. But anyway, they should educate themselves and they should be voting. Yes, when you're younger, you tend to see things more liberally, that life needs to be more fair. And we all know life is not fair. If life was fair, all four of my children would be alive today, not just my older son. And if life was fair, cheetahs wouldn't eat the lame gazelles. Okay? So anyway, back to that. Less than 40% of the eligible voting population between ages 18 to 29 actually voted in 2018. And of all categories, all ages, all groups, all of that stuff, 53% voted in 2018. So out of all of the people eligible to vote in the United States, in 2018, only 53% voted. That means 47% did not. Do you not think that that 47% could have changed the outcome of a few things? I think so. And even if, let's say, 20% of that 47% were incapacitated in some manner, comatose in a hospital, Alzheimer's in nursing homes, or dementia, or, you know, cancer patients who just are out of it, don't have a clue, wouldn't be able to sign in front of a notary. So that means 80% of the voting population, eligible voters in the United States, if 80% of them were voting, a lot of things would be different, because most of the people don't live in New York City and Chicago and San Francisco. I know I'm fighting an uphill battle. It's just where I am. It's where I've always been. Okay, so you think it doesn't matter. Well, so do it anyway. Educate yourself. Vote for the lesser of the two evils. And eventually we're going to filter out the idiots. I mean, for heaven's sakes, Rand and Ron Paul vote. They ran for office and served. If it's good enough for them, it's got to be good enough for you. Oh, I know. It's just, look, I'm not going to be screaming the sky is falling. You know, the alphabet media out there on television is screaming the sky's going to fall on us. The sky's coming. Oh, my gosh, it's going to be the end of democracy. Hint, we're not democracy. A democracy means majority wins. And if majority wins, the conservatives would be winning all the time. Anyways, so the same thing's going on with the AM talk radio big heads. Okay, they're screaming, get out and vote. Oh my God, get out and vote. We're going to lose. You got to get there. And what they're trying to gin you up. I get it. They're trying to get you motivated to go out there, motivating you with fear, trying to tell you the world's coming to an end. Your life as you know may end, and it might, I guess. And it's possible that as we, if things turn out opposite of the way I'd like them to turn out today across the nation, we may be entering into a Marxist type life. Wouldn't be the first time in human civilization that communism and socialism ran a country and ran it into the ground. I don't want to be China. I don't want to live in China, which is another reason why I'd like to build up my Bitcoin, so that as things start going south, if they do, my father and my mother-in-law are up there in age. I don't wish them away in any shape or form. But the fact of life is that regardless, they're not going to be here much longer, maybe 20 years. That's not long. So when their time is finished, there's nothing holding me here. There's no reason I can't sell everything I've got and head to a country that's more appreciative, not only of my Bitcoin, but what may be the US dollar at the time. I mean, I don't know, but someplace that cost of living is almost negligible. And I mean, I don't have to stay here is basically the point. I want to. This is my home. But I'm not above leaving if I have to. Now, for most of the year, we've heard the word fascist used by both sides. You know, the liberal side is screaming, these are fascists just like the Nazis. And the conservatives are screaming, they're the neo-fascists, you know, and instead of looking up the word fascist or fascism on the internet anywhere, because I don't trust wikis. They'll say whatever the programmers want them to say. I've already seen the online Webster's Dictionary change the definition of genders and all kinds of things. It's just absolutely insane. So I don't trust it. I don't trust it. I grabbed the 1993 third edition hard copy of the American Heritage College Dictionary. I actually have it here so my viewing audience can see. There it is. My listening audience, you just got to hear me. Maybe you got to hear me lift the book up and groan a little bit. So, how did he hear somebody walking up the street and bark at him? That's crazy. Yeah, that's Bob barking, by the way. No, it's not Bob Barker. It's Bob White. He is barking. So, fascist is defined by that hard copy dictionary from 1993 as an advocate or adherent of fascism, a reactionary or dictatorial person. Fascism, and of course, you know, you have to go back to the original word. Fascism is defined as a system of government marked by a totalitarian dictator, socioeconomic controls, suppression of the oppression. Nope, wrong. Suppression of the opposition. Suppression of the opposition. And usually a policy of belligerent nationalism and racism. A political philosophy or movement based on or advocating such a system. Oppressive dictatorial control. So once again, fascism is defined as a system of government marked by a totalitarian dictator, socioeconomic controls, suppression of the opposition, and usually a policy of belligerent nationalism and racism. A political philosophy or movement based on or advocating such a system, oppressive dictatorial control. How many 18 to 29-year-old voters do you think know the original definition, not the wiki or the social media definition? What are they teaching our kids in school? Well, I can tell you one thing they're not teaching them is about traditional hard-nosed Democratic politics in Southern West Virginia. And this is where I get to the fun part. We're about to have a chime of the clock here in just a minute, depending on how far it is off from my clock here. So I'm going to, I'm going to start with, I Made a Difference by Earl Hager, Mr. Hager, bless his heart. He was a good man. He had somebody, he, by the time I met him and was working with him on the Conservation District Board, he wasn't driving himself or anything, and he had some challenges, but he was a really good man, bright man. So Mr. Hager, he was a local political operative in Southern West Virginia, in Lincoln County, West Virginia. He was born in 1909 near Gill, West Virginia. He graduated from Berea College Academy. Later received his undergraduate and graduate degrees from Marshall College. It's now Marshall University. In 1933, Mr. Hager began teaching in the public schools, retiring in 1973. His political career began in 1944, Although he retired from the West Virginia legislature in 1973, he remained politically active. So among the, in the section that where he talks about his political career, these two fellows, they cross paths. And I want to share this with you just a little bit. Because this is the stuff you hear about and you don't believe it actually really happened. Well, here it is in black and white. Out of the mouth of the, out of the donkey's mouth. This little piece is 10 pounds of butter. It's the subtitle of this this section of the chapter. And he tells about meeting, early on, before the piece that I really want to share with you, he talks about meeting a lady who had been elected to the executive committee in Logan. And there are chairmen and chairwomen for the executive committees of the political parties. I'm assuming that's everywhere, not just West Virginia. I've never been on a political party executive committee anywhere but West Virginia. So he met her, and he talks about how important her work was, because as a committee woman, an executive committee woman, she was able to choose who worked the polls, obviously, and she encouraged people how to vote. And at the time, you could get away with it doing it at the polls, because what you had is you were supposed to have a in each of the positions in the polling place. So you have, you know, different stages. You know, you go in and you show your ID, and then you get your ballot, and then you sign this, and then you move over here, and then you turn your ballot in, and then so there's supposed to be a Democrat and a Republican at each of those stations. But what you have is you have people who are actually Democrat in heart, registered Republicans, so that they can work the polls. I used to be a chairwoman, and I had more than one person say, "Yeah, I'm a Democrat, but I like to work the polls." So, you know, I changed them out. Oh, it made people mad. Anyway, so because she was fairly powerful in that small community, her husband was a county jailer. And it provided them with a house and an excellent salary. And she was a key member of the executive committee down through the years. And he was able to maintain his job for a long time. Well, Mr. Hager ends up working for a campaign that is opposite of the ones that she supported. And she ends up being ousted as the committee person. And her husband loses his job. And they end up having to go find a home. They get a small farm, and they get a small farm, and he is on a different campaign at a later time, and he's tying these stories together. And he said he went out to the old man's house. Now he never names these people. He never named this couple here, I should say. He never names them. He just had some small talk, and finally asked the guy's wife if his wife was satisfied living out there, and if she had found something to do to keep busy. That's not a sexist thing, but remember what year this is. He said she had adjusted. The husband said she had adjusted to it. She had a couple of cows that she milked and sold the milk and the butter, and that brought in a little bit of cash income. And says, "I told him I had wanted to buy some fresh butter, but didn't know where to find it. So before I left, I would like to purchase a pound of butter." Now, you'll recognize this, if you think about it, as a good old-fashioned, "I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine." So if you listen to me and you agree on what we've been talking about, I'll buy some butter from you. Said he still not had mentioned the election where she ended up losing her position. And when I got ready to leave, I gave him $10, which, remember, this is back in the 60s, and asked him for a pound of butter. Since she sold butter for $1 a pound, I expected to get $9 back in change. But when he returned, he brought me 10 pounds of butter and no change. He said, "You'll be traveling through the county today, and you have a lot of friends and will need something to give them." "We don't have change for the 10, but we gave you 10 pounds of butter." He said he had talked to his wife and they had forgiven me. "We've been awfully angry over what had happened in the last election, but we've forgiven you for that, and we're going to give you our support again." He told me to check the election returns when they came in. So what do we have here? Buying votes for butter. Here, I thought I'd come by and introduce myself. I'm running for office. Here's a pound of butter. Can I count on your vote? Now, he ends up meeting a guy named Raymond Chapin, who is the other book. Raymond Chapin's a little more powerful than Mr. Hager. They're also a lot different personalities. He says, "I had difficulty with Raymond Chapin, the political chief of Logan County. He was against me because I was lined up with a faction that opposed him. The reason I was with this particular faction was to get the needed organizational help. So just before the election, I decided to contact Mr. Chapin and see if I could get some of his support, if not at all." So he says, "About a week before the election, I called his house early in the morning. His wife answered the phone and said he was not up yet, but she was fixing breakfast. She asked me to come over and have breakfast and talk with him, and I accepted her invitation. It was about a 15-mile drive. And now remember, we're not talking about U.S. highway, you know, concrete roads here. We're talking lane and a half, backwoods, mud hole roads. Let's see. We ate. Mr. Chapin explained that the reason he did not support me was I was with political faction that opposed him and was costing him votes. Even after I explained to him why I had joined up with that faction, he indicated he was still opposed to me. At that point, ladies, pay attention. At that point, his wife took over the conversation. She was a teacher in the public schools, and she told Raymond that I had done more for public education while I was in the legislature than anyone else who represented Logan County. She firmly told him that she was going to give me all her support and said, "I'm serving as a commissioner in the House on election day, and for every slate that you send in to the polling house, I'm going to see that Earl gets that vote." Now, slate, in case you didn't know, well, I don't have anything ready to show you, is a list. It's a list of endorsed candidates that at this point in time, usually the unions or obviously political factions would have printed up with their endorsed candidates for each office. Now, we see it a lot online on the internet. We see like West Virginia's For Life, well, for me, it's West Virginia for Life. The National Right to Life will say, "These are our candidates. You know, these are who we support. We've given our endorsement." So it's kind of like that, only slate is illegal because people, it's because the slate was coming with political pressure. And even really, believe it or not, their votes were being checked. So one, either the Republican or the Democrat, usually the Republican, who was actually a Democrat at heart, would be watching you vote and making sure, because it wasn't the machines here. You know, you were doing a paper ballot and they were watching you vote and they were looking up and nodding at somebody. And if you voted the way you were supposed to, somebody was keeping a tally. So I'm going to see that Raymond gets the vote, or Earl gets the vote. Raymond looked at her and looked at me. Then a smile came on his face and he said, "It looks to me like I don't have any choice but to give you a few votes." The conversation ended at that time and Raymond asked if he could have a ride because his wife wanted to use the car. And this is before there was multiple. And the odd thing here is not only that the wife wanted to use the car, was that the wife was able, as in knew how to drive. Back in these times, it was very rare for a woman to know how to drive. especially in southern West Virginia. So, my feeling is that a candidate, when campaigning, regardless of whether with friends or enemies, should be able to talk decently to anyone. He may not get everyone's help or support, but they will appreciate his attitude. Lord, if we could just have some of that there today. Oh, man. Campaigning is just like any business. Sometimes products sell, and sometimes they don't. The next section, he talks about meeting John Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, as he's running for president. And it says before there was a rally down in Logan County. And before, now this ties into where I'm getting ready to go here in just a minute. Before the rally, he came into an eating establishment, which is named in the next book, that was used on a regular basis by the Chamber of Commerce, Kiwanis Club, Lions Club, and other organizations in the Logan area. This restaurant seated about 100 to 150 people. And the Chamber of Commerce had invited Kennedy to speak at a dinner there. The general public was waiting to see him as he entered the front door. That is where I was introduced to him. A public official had mentioned to him that I served in the West Virginia legislature. Kennedy shook my hand and congratulated me. He said public service was very interesting work and a wonderful service to render to the county and the state. Mr. Kennedy exuded warmth and friendliness to everyone, and his story was very inspiring. So he meets Kennedy at the same place Raymond Chatham gets to talk to Kennedy. I hope you're not being you're not too bored with this. So Raymond Chatham, you see, it doesn't say what year he was born here, but he passed away in what year was it? 2008. I met him in 2000. He came to my political science class at the college. It says, Just Good Politics is the autobiography of Raymond Chatham, the savvy, freewheeling political boss from Logan County, West Virginia, who managed political machinery for the election of several state governors, U.S. senators, and in 1960 for John F. Kennedy. Chafin's story includes the true account of his role in the historic primary that ended Hubert Humphrey's bid for the presidency and gave Kennedy the momentum he needed to win the National Democratic nomination. Now, I will tell you right now, a little spoiler alert here. There's a couple times when Chafin writes in here that these things were said and we agreed not to talk about it. So I'm always a little suspicious of those kind of comments. But, you know, let me see, where are my tags here? A lot of these flags are from when I was in school. Chatham asked somebody, boy, I'm kind of stumped over here. How's this fellow Humphreys doing with you? They said generally that Hubert Humphreys had started out all right. He'd weakened some since the beginning of the campaign. What about Kennedy? In almost every case, religion came up. The other county leaders had the same thing as we did in Logan. A lot of holiness churches, fundamentalists, and most of these people just didn't know what to make of Kennedy's Catholicism. So it was a big leap for most of the people in Southern coalfields to support a Catholic. Okay? Because, well, that goes into stuff for another time. There's another one of those notes. So on April 25th, John Kennedy got himself a big tour bus to carry him and his people through southern West Virginia. He came through McDowell County, through Yeager, and up Island Creek, making speeches and shaking hands the whole way through. When they hit Omar, somebody had set up a place in the parking lot of Shaheen's Shopping Center for him to talk. And so that would be kind of like setting up at a Walmart, except this was a local guy. My wife took our daughters, our daughter, Margaret, who was about 11 years old at the time, and they went down there to hear Senator Kennedy speak. They had timed the rally with a shift change at the mines so that there were scores of miners in their work clothes listening to JFK talk about West Virginia. There were some 200 people in that crowd. All of people, a local photographer chose to zero in on Louise and Margaret, my wife and daughter. Snap, snap, snap. That week, the picture ended up in a local newspaper. There they were, right there with John Kennedy. It caused me no end of talk. Raymond Chafin's family at a Kennedy rally? People were saying Louise and Margaret had made the headlines while I'd made the funny papers. Long backstory. We're on page 128. So. I wanted to hear him, Louise told him. I like him. Which is something, honestly, if I had Trump's ear, big bus, not overly decorated, very, very modest bus, southern communities, they need to realize that people still live a lot like this down in the southern coal fields of West Virginia. It's pretty bad down there. And, you know, they need to be down there looking. Anyway. Since Kennedy had been touring around with his bus, this is a different day, and he stopped to spend the night in Logan. Of all places, they checked him into our own Aracoma Hotel, home to room 220, the Chafin faction office. Now, earlier in the book, he talks about his political meetings that he was holding in that room. So he would rent the room and they'd all meet and drink and smoke and all that stuff. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Kennedy's people came to me and asked whether I couldn't talk with their candidate again. I said I would, and they would, and they took me upstairs to his room. So he's not down in the restaurant. The restaurant which Earl mentions, this is the same dinner event that Earl mentioned just a few minutes ago. So now Raymond Chafin's being invited up to the hotel room. Kennedy began speaking at the county courthouse that day and was scheduled for radio interviews at Smokehouse Restaurant that night. He told the newsman downstairs that he was going up to get some dinner in his room and a shower before the interview. Nobody knew it, and I was damn glad of it, but I was already up there. He walked in, we shook hands, and we talked alone about 20 minutes. Alone. Senator Kennedy's in there alone? And I don't know where the wife and the Secret Service were. Well, maybe they didn't have Secret Service for senators then. I don't know. I've heard that you have more influence here than anyone else, he said. I'd appreciate your support in this primary. I told him that I'd been telling some of his aides all along. It was my feeling that the people he'd gotten with in West Virginia, the ones I knew about, cared more about feathering their own nests than about national politics. They don't care whether you're president or not. They just want your money to run their campaigns. We see a lot of that now. We see a lot of that now. Pollsters, big talkers, couldn't tell you which shoe was the right shoe, but they get paid big old dollars to run these campaigns or to prophesy on the outcome of elections. And when they're wrong, nobody remembers. He asked me why I couldn't help him. And I said I would like to have been all along, but the people I'm with, they're for the other guy. He said, and to tell you the truth, I'm not that interested in it. It doesn't matter to me whether you or Humphreys is president. I don't think your race is going to mean a lot to us either way. Hearing this, Jack Kennedy really let go on me. That's where you're wrong. I'll mean more to you in West Virginia than anyone else in this race. I'll do more here because I've been here. I've seen how much you people need. He said he met the coal miners who told him something about health and safety in the mines. He'd been touring all through the southern mountains where the people were hard hit by poverty and unemployment. He got me to talking too about the roads and the dams we need for flood control. And finally, Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts made me a promise. If I become president, he said, I'll talk with you personally in Washington. You and I will sit down and we'll discuss getting something done about these problems in southern West Virginia. One thing, though, I said, we can't tell anyone we ever met here tonight. It'll be between you and me, John Kennedy said. We won't discuss it. things. Maybe that's true, but you can't prove it. All right, so I know you're getting tired. I'm not trying to bore you to death reading this, but I want you to see, I want you to understand politics in West Virginia and in Southern West Virginia. It's still like this a lot. Maybe not as covert, maybe a little more overt. Maybe they pay people for their votes in different ways these days. And to be honest with you, all of the help that John Kennedy did, he started the welfare program in Southern West Virginia and stuff, it really hasn't helped in the long run. Pardon me. And our great Senator Robert Byrd, all hail the great Robert Byrd, we had federal dollars coming in here by the bucketfuls, bucketfuls. We've got three interstates that connect in the heart of our city, of our state, in our capital city. And what good has it done us? We're still struggling. We're still struggling. All right. So, I'm going to try to I've gone over an hour now. I'm going to try to roll this up. But there's a couple of things I still need you to understand. So Raymond Chavin is telling here a couple of different pieces, and I'm just going to slam them together. I hopefully they'll make sense. The Kennedy campaign bouncers, if you want to call them that, reached out to him and invited him to Massachusetts for a meeting. And so he gets in, Baltimore. So he gets to Baltimore and he gets into this meeting. And they're asking him, what's it going to take? What does it take to run a campaign in your part of West Virginia? And he said, he showed him one of the cards, and they asked what it was. And he told him, he said, that's a, I'm trying to find it here. Oh, where is it? A slate. Anyway, he tells them about that. It's a slate. And they said, what's a slate? So he explains it to them. These guys, I guess, in the campaign had never heard of a slate. And he explained it to them. And he told them it takes about $100,000 all told for all the candidates, all the races and everything in Southern West Virginia and Logan County to finance a campaign. And he tells them, he says, the money spent part to hire car drivers to transport people back and forth to vote, part to pay the workers at the polls on election day, part to have people pass out information. And he says here, and there's no pointing in denying it now to buy votes. Yeah, dollar swaller. I'm not just talking about cash exchanges, although that happened too. Just as often we'd pay for a driver's license for somebody who couldn't afford it, or an electric bill or something like that. Of course, the main tool we had for telling everyone where we stood was the slates, the cards with all our candidates' names on them, and my name at the bottom. These fellas in the hotel lounge, which are the Kennedy campaign people, became real interested in the slates, and I showed them a sample of one we'd already had printed. Hubert Humphrey was name on top, because now remember, he's not supposed to be telling people that he's going to support John Kennedy. They passed the cards around and looked at them. One fella asked me, what would it take to take Humphrey's name off the slate and get John Kennedy's name on it? And he was wanting a dollar amount. Said, I'd already gotten most of the campaign set up and I didn't need much. So I decided to keep the figure real small, just four digits, a little more than what my local candidate donated. About 35, I said, meaning $3,500. $3,500. That's no problem, the fellas replied. We'll take care of that. No problem. They agreed to have a new batch of slates printed up. So he's getting the $3,500 plus the reprint on the slates. And back in the 60s, that was not cheap. You didn't just run down to Kinko's. Have them print them up in New York with Kennedy's name. So then he tells of how when it was time to pick all this stuff up, the reprinted slates, and the campaign cash that they were sending to him. He got a call and he got a hold of his buddy, Bus Perry, and met them at the local airport, at a local airport, not the local airport, but. And he asks Bus Perry, he said, don't repeat anything. Don't tell anybody about what's going on, what you see going on here. So, yeah, here it is. So, I'm sorry. I couldn't hardly see the little blue flag. I was looking for my yellow ones. So, the plane came down and we started out there. Come on, I have some campaign literature to pick up. And so, they had the campaign literature in two big sealed briefcases. He said, he didn't know how much cash was in those cases, and to tell you the truth, neither did I. I told Bus to get his list of precincts ready, and we'd be figuring out some of the money that we'd be paying our workers. The bus dropped me off downtown, quickly returning to the gun. He'd picked up a gun to take with him just in case something bad happened. Hey, Elvie, let's you and me take a ride up Cow Creek. Elvie's somebody different. At my place, we cut away the seals and opened those cases, talking about the briefcases, and saw all that money separated in packages of $5, $10, and $20 bills. Oh, my God, Elvie, I said. We sure got everything we need now. But the more I looked, the more I knew someone in Kennedy's outfit had misunderstood me. I realized then that those men in Baltimore came from a whole different world than I did. They spoke a different language. I'd said one thing, they heard another. I said 35 talking in hundreds, they heard thousands. There was $35,000 in those cases, plus more money for some of my contacts in the other counties. I got on the phone to Jim McKay. I believe they made a mistake. They sent more than we told them. Hell no, there's no mistake. We know you're doing a good job. So in black and white, in the book Just Good Politics, and an hour and 17 minutes later, the fact of the matter is the John Kennedy campaign indeed dumped $35,000, not counting the cost of printing slates to hand out amongst all the southern counties, into West Virginia to beat Hubert Humphreys for the Democratic nominee for president. That's a fact, Jack. That's a fact, Jack. There you go. That's politics. And I doubt that it's just in West Virginia. I suspect that kind of stuff. And it probably still goes on. Remember when Hillary went to the southern West Virginia and that, that miner got all kinds of popular because he put her in her place? And she was embarrassed by it. She was trying to pull a John Kennedy. I know she was. I knew it when I saw it. I said, she's trying to do just what John Kennedy did. So, that's a wrap for episode 6 of the Holstein House podcast. Oh, no, episode 7. You would think I could get that right. That's a wrap for episode 7 of the Holstein House podcast. But before I go, I swear I'm almost done. I want to share out one final round of supporters. HJ is still hanging on with 115 boosted sats. HJ, I think you're higher than that since I jotted that note to myself. And I appreciate it. I really do. I do appreciate it. You guys have no idea. You have no idea. User, and I think this person just did it to make me rattle off all of these numbers. User 29710196654901 boosted 475 sats. Thank you very much. The dude boosted 95 sats. And I don't know how to pronounce top. Wakone, T-O-P-W-K-O-N-E. I wish I could hear you tell me how to pronounce that. Maybe you could spell it out phonetically somewhere. Boosted 95 Satch. Guichone, G-U-I-C-H-O-N-E, boosted 238 sats. Superorius, S-U-P-E-R-J-O-R-I-S, 95 sats. Euphrosinus, E-U-P-H-R-O-S-Y-N-O-S. Boosted 143 stats under spiritual warfare boost. And I appreciate that greatly. And would also like to know the phonetic pronunciation of your name. I used to know the names of the five muses, and that's awfully close to one of them, but I don't think it's exactly it. I may have to look that up. And then another 1,425 sat boost for holiday dinners with ham and chicken, because Euphrosinus doesn't like turkey, or at least prefers ham and chicken for the holidays. And honestly, wow, I need one of those special sound effects. I need to get, but they're awfully expensive, one of those board things that everybody's getting for their podcast that you hook to the computer and you have your sound guy in there punching buttons and making rude noises and stuff. And I could get that one that says boost. Could do that or something. I'll come up with something. How about this one? What do you think? But I can't do it in real time until I figure out how to do it in real time on StreamYard. I can look that up. I'll look that up and see if I can do it. But yeah, 1,425. Now, see if you were a Kennedy. That'd be 14,250. I'm just teasing. And Ivo Jan Jensens. I-V-O-J-A-N-S-S-E-N-S. Boosted 95. And I appreciate that too. I appreciate all of them. I know a lot of times people say that and you can tell they kind of say it out of by rote, by habit, because they, you know, it's kind of like, okay, now I got to read this. No. This is so much, it's fun and it's encouraging, and I like sharing this information with you. And I hope to fine tune. I know in my mind what I wanted to achieve, and I'm kind of sort of getting there. Not real good, but I'm kind of sort of getting there. So continue to pray for our country. Well, pray for the world, really. But in the United States, as Election Day rolls to a close, pray that whatever the outcomes are, that we don't have these insane riots, that we can return to dignified discussion instead of this bomb-throwing nonsense that we've got going on here. We shouldn't be labeling people as racists and anarchists and crazy this and crazy that, and they're going to starve your children, they're going to starve your grandma. Can we please get back to a little bit of sense? Can we please get back to debating the issues that concern us and stuff? The minute somebody calls somebody else a name, they have lost the argument. The problem is the other side then in turn calls somebody a name. And so, you know, two losers. But please continue to pray for our nation and the world, because there's some dark things coming. You know, we may come out better on the other end, but until we get there, it's going to be hard. So there you have it. Post your comments, do all the boosting and liking and sharing. We premiered on the Fountain Network. Our podcast premiered on the Fountain Network. If you found me on the Fountain Network, I hope you will boost, clip, and share. If you found me somewhere else, I hope you'll reach out and let me know, because I'd like to know where everyone's at and I'd like to be able to interact with you. And so I will update the show notes as best I can with links to the things that I've talked about and get them posted too. Just be kind to each other. I mean, come on. It's okay to disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable. Okay? That's a wrap. So, there you have it. Post your comments, do all that boosting, liking, sharing, thumbs up, and stuff that helps spread the word and poke the algorithms. Follow me on most of the big social media platforms and look for my name, Robin Holstein, or Holstein House. Till next time, bye-bye.